Hello, welcome to the Donna Lana Kitchen. Here we go. Donna Lana Kitchen talks about food. Donna Lana Kitchen talks recipes. Donna Lana Kitchen talks about lots of other things on KHOI Radio. Woohoo! I'm Lana Noctigal.
And Donna Prisgintas.
And we are the Donna Lana Kitchen. We're here to talk about food, about farming, about recipes, advice, and opinions.
And today, fermentation.
Today we're going to explore a bit of the wild world of fermentation. We share the world with bacteria and we eat some every day. If you think that sounds like a pretty bad idea, stick around because it's not. You may discover just how important fermented foods are. Products of fermentation have been part of our diet for a long, long time in almost every region of the world. Fermented foods are celebrated for their flavors, textures, and aroma. They are being rediscovered for their beneficial healing properties. They've been relied upon for the ability to preserve food. They make some things much easier for the human body to digest. Fermented foods add variety to our lives, and they taste good, too. So here's some examples of fermented foods. Without enzymes, bacteria, and yeast, we would not be able to enjoy things like cheese, bread, yogurt, olives, chocolate, kimchi, beer, vinegar, coffee, wine, sauerkraut, vanilla, cured meats of all kinds, hard apple cider,
champagne.
Oh, very good. All sorts of stuff we'd not be enjoying as much as we do. Fermented foods really are a part of our lives already, and we can even explore more. Not all the flavors of fermented foods are loved by everyone. Think of the taste of strong, stinky cheeses, something I rather enjoy, but some people don't. It's an acquired taste. Some of these tastes take some getting used to. Some flavors like yogurt or chocolate or beer may be already part of your diet. But if you give the world of fermented foods a try, you may find yourself just coming back for more.
The main impetus for us to talk about fermented foods today is because, of course, Sander Katz is going to be coming to town. He is the author of The Art of Fermentation, which won a James Beard Award this year. So we'll be talking a little bit about him today. But I also wanted to talk about a metaphor. Really, fermentation is a metaphor for some other things in life because it is about symbiotic relationships. You know, you put all these little living beings from the fermented food inside your belly, which helps you to digest and to formulate other elements needed. Some of them, you know, make B12 in your body and things like that. So this is a relationship that we have with these fungal and microbial forms. There's a word called biomimicry, where culture mimics or even design can mimic biology. So I want to read a little quote that Fred Kirschman wrote in the latest Leopold newsletter. So Fred says, in an article published in the online American Scientist in 2013, Bradford Harris provided an intriguing interpretation of the theory of evolution, originally titled Evolution Reinterpreted, Survival of the Friendliest. Harris's article pointed out that Darwin's original theory of evolution was heavily influenced by the philosophy of Adam Smith, and this is survival of the fittest, and that this version of evolution became extremely popular for two reasons. Quote, it morally liberated people to be selfish, and it intellectually liberated them to interpret a range of complicated questions in terms of simpler individual parts. That would be their own self-interest. So then Fred continues, so we have now reached a point where the whole new theory of evolution, the survival of the friendliest instead of the survival of the fittest, and new social theories that set the path to health and quality of life based in cooperation and harmony instead of domination and conflict. They all converge to lead us in a new direction with the potential to heal both our planet and ourselves. So I'm seeing this upsurge in interest in fermentation. As a good sign of a socially moral shift more towards collective support of one another and survival of the friendliest.
I really like this concept. First time I've heard it. Survival of the friendliest. That seems to make a lot more sense and bodes a little better for everyone's health if we take on our body as something to be a friendly part of the environment that we're in. We share the planet with all sorts of bacteria and small little things, and we're just beginning to understand that. That's very, very important.
So we can all take direct personal action by eating these little friendly microbial beings and cultivating them and enjoying the healthy benefits of them.
Yeah, we're becoming more aware that healthy bacterial microflora is essential to our health. We're all part of a bigger interconnected world. The bacteria in our intestines live in complex communities that help digest our foods and make nutrients available and regulate our immune responses. Who knew we had so much going on? With our exposure to environmental toxins, what exactly was in that last bag of synthetic cheese doodles that I ate anyway? Okay, with our environmental...
It's the orange
With all our exposure to all that stuff, and also with our increasing use of antibiotic and antibacterial products, we may need to help restore ourselves with bacteria-rich foods. These fermented bacteria-laden foods can help us diversify our gut bacteria. Gut, a good word, I understand gut, and stimulate our immune systems. Beneficial bacteria, probiotics, are available in capsule form. Many more people are becoming aware of that. But it's nice to know that all this good stuff is in a variety of fermented food. If the fermented food has not been cooked or heat processed after fermentation, you want to keep this stuff alive. There's a lot of good stuff out there to explore. Let's find out about some fermented foods.
Well, I took a little trip to Wheatsfield yesterday because I thought, you know, Lana and I are going to talk about, and certainly Sander Katz is going to encourage all of us to make our own fermented foods. But sometimes, we just don't have time or don't get around to it or aren't familiar with it. So I was looking around to see what was actually available, already prepared. Sometimes you have to taste something before you actually want to go to the trouble of making it yourself. So I was looking at Wheatsfield. They have whole cases of beverages, misos, also most sauerkrauts were originally fermented. Now, the problem with processed foods is a lot of times if you buy sauerkraut, especially if it's in a can, but even in the refrigerated case, it has already been pasteurized, which means that the probiotics in it and the little friendly creatures are dead. Which, while it tastes good and doesn't hurt you, it does not benefit you in the same way that the ones with the live cultures do. So one thing kind of universal about all of these fermented foods is you don't want to, in any cooking sequence or anything, take them up past body temperature too much. Because then, you know, you will sort of heat the life out of it, so to speak.
It's body temperature.
Yeah, well, just tiny bit above, you know, what would
overly
feel
warm, a fever.
Baby, you know how we used to shake on your wrist something for a baby bottle to see if it was too hot? You know, whatever is, you know, that level of comfort. So I found already produced things. There's a company called Wild Brine, which makes a red beet cabbage, which I'm spilling all over the table. It's a gorgeous color, really magenta. And there's a sauerkraut, and I think there's some kombuchas. And then there are all kinds of beverages that pre-bottled living kombuchas that Lana's going to talk about making your own. But if you need to get inspired to make your own, I would suggest trying some of the already, you know, prepared products. There's also a Iowa company called Agricultured, which I think will, I know it was at the farmer's market in Ames this summer. I think it will eventually become available at Wheatsfield. They're also presenting at Practical Farmers of Iowa, and they make a lot of cultured products. So, of course, I was quite lazy this summer and just bought the things already made. I did find some, I'm going to talk about kefir a little bit later. But I found a product made with a kefir culture. The one I make is with milk. The one at the co-op is called Kavita, which is a sparkling probiotic drink. There's also another Iowa company called Shock Tea from Fairfield, which is a kombucha. Alana, why don't you talk about your kombucha experiences?
Oh, kombucha. I've been making my own kombucha, which is a sparkling fermented tea. You don't think that tastes good, but yes, it does. It's a sparkling fermented tea. I've been making it for about, oh, year and a half now on my kitchen counter. Kombucha is a lightly effervescent fermented drink of sweet black tea. It's produced by fermenting the tea using a symbiotic colony of bacteria and yeast.
Called a SCOBY. Symbiotic colony of bacteria and yeast. Yes. SCOBY. Scooby-Dooby.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. S-C-O-B-Y. When I was first introduced to this thing, like Donna talked about, it's best to taste it first. And I've tasted some other homemade things and tasted kombucha that's commercially available too. You'll be surprised. Describe it as, it's sort of like vinegar. It's sort of like cider. It's sort of like sparkling water or sparkling wine. It's sort of like iced tea. Sort of.
Plus, you can flavor it.
Right. It can take on sour. It can take on sweet. It depends on how you make it. And that's why tasting a lot of different ones. For one thing, don't grab onto it and expect anything else but kombucha. It's not iced tea. And it's not anything else. It's an acquired taste. It's quite lovely.
Well, there's another communal aspect to this. In order to make your kombucha, you have to get a SCOBY from someone who's already making kombucha. So you have to taste someone else's, and then they have to share their SCOBY with you because the SCOBY keeps growing. It's like a sourdough starter, and kefir is the same way. So it is a multi-leveled community metaphor.
Yes. When I was first introduced to this, my friend Zach brought me this thing in a bowl. And it's not the sort of thing that you're, on first glance, would be glad to get. It looks like a wet, slimy, sluggy, sort of round thing.
I think it looks like wet, clear shoe leather.
Oh, yes. Now, doesn't this taste good? Or doesn't this sound like it would taste good? But that is the living culture. It is not a mushroom.
Although that's the SCOBY.
That's the SCOBY. The symbiotic colony of bacteria and yeast. And it is two living things. Think of, it's many living things, but it's a colony of bacteria and a colony of yeast. But you can think of it as sort of a mushroom sort of thing, but it's very wet. And keeping it wet is very important because it lives on the sugars in a very sweet tea.
So actually, what do? You make a big, like a gallon of tea, right? Green or black.
Mm-hmm.
You add the sugar, mm-hmm. cool it all to room temperature.
Mm-hmm.
Then you put the SCOBY in, mm-hmm. right? Then right. What?
Oh, then, back up a little bit.
Okay.
That's the quick way to do it. I mean, that's the general idea. You're brewing this. It's kind of like sun tea, but it takes a lot longer. Think of it as SCOBY tea. I make it a gallon at a time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's important to start with a glass jar, or you could do it in a ceramic jar, too. You need something that is non-reactive. You're dealing with a little acidity here, so don't do it in plastic or don't do it in metal. So the thing that
especially not aluminum.
Oh, especially not aluminum. No, because it will react and not only change the flavor, but heaven knows what you'll be ingesting. My glass jar is a gallon jar. It's about 10 inches high and about 7 inches wide. And it's important. You don't want to do this in a jug, as in with a small lid or small neck. You want a wide open space. So my opening for this jar is 4.5 inches. I can get my. You want to get your hand in there.
Right. It needs good airflow.
It needs good airflow, and you want the scooby actually open to the air. So clean glass jar with a wide top. You could do it in a wider sort of bowl, too, but I like to make a gallon at a time. So for then this gallon jar gives me about 3 quart jars of finished tea, because each time, similar to a sourdough, you save the scooby and you save a little bit of the previous kombucha to keep the scooby wet.
For inoculation.
For inoculation. Got it. So here's some generally what you need besides that big glass jar. 3.5 quarts of water, cup of white sugar, and eight bags or so of bagged tea, sort of. I use a strong black tea because I like black tea, but I've made it with a lot of other things. There's not one way to make it. It's just that black tea works well for the as a home for the scooby to work. I've also added green tea. I've also added flavored teas. You can also add herbs, a little apple juice, things like that. I've used mint leaves from the garden. I've used dried hibiscus flowers. And it all works pretty well. But I go heavy on the black tea. So, and it's the sugar and the black tea gives that home for the scooby to work. So,
now, wait a minute. During the brewing process, you have, like, the mint leaves in it?
Now, I do. I brew everything together. However, I've read that you're supposed to add all that stuff later, but I don't. This is, I've done it all. I've done it all together.
So it works if you put it all
works,
in?
It works just fine.
Good.
There is a caveat that I've read and I've noticed, too. If you put in flavored teas, like Earl Grey or something that has more essential oils in it, it does tend to slow down the scooby. But this stuff, scooby is really tough. It pretty much will work with anything.
Like shoe leather.
It is. It is. It responds to heat, light. It responds to the sugars. Another thing, white sugar is really the best. You can make with any other kind of sugar, molasses or brown sugar or anything else. There's a little note about don't use honey a lot. It will really slow it down. There's other bacteria in honey, and it's not like it's going to kill your scooby, but it's different things happen.
Competing environment.
Yes,
there.
Be aware that there's a life form going on. Okay.
Multiple life forms.
Right. So you bring all this wonderful stuff to a boil, and you can use a metal soup pot for that.
Stainless steel.
Stainless steel, because it's not going to be in there that long. Then you cool it down. There's a lot of meanwhile here. You bring it to a boil, cool it up. Meanwhile, go do something else. Then you come back.
And the cooling down is that one thing. It has to be below, you know, body temperature, room
temperature.
Something like that.
Much less than bath water. You don't want to shock this poor thing. Okay. Once the tea is cooled, you remove the tea bags or strain out loose tea or any of the things that are swimming around in there. And then I add the tea to the big glass jar and scoop up. I use my hands. Be sure your hands are clean. This is important, too.
You know, Sander Katz makes a point in his book. He talks in the hygiene directions. He talks about the difference between clean and sterile.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was a very, you know, clean is good.
Mm-hmm.
And it's always good in cooking. Clean, you know, wash your hands, wash your things. Rinse them well. Sterile is not necessarily that good, because to get to sterility, you know, you often use products that are a little bit nasty, or even if it's a lot of hot water. Sterile is not the point. This is
right.
Not surgery. This is
right.
Alive, you know, there are wild yeasts around us. We don't want to kill them off. So clean is really important. Sterile is not the objective.
Right. We're all in this together, including the Scooby. Mm-hmm. So the Scooby is slid into the cool tea in the big glass jar, and then you dump in what you have saved or what some nice person's given you along with the Scooby, the inoculation
amount.
Tea from the last batch. It's kind of like sourdough or any other thing like that. Then I usually ferment it for 7 to 10 days. You taste it as it's working. The Scooby is going to float, and it may look like sort of like an octopus in there for a while. It may sort of look like...
But it doesn't have tentacles too much.
No. It's not unusual for the Scooby to float at the top or the bottom or sideways. A new cream-colored layer of Scooby should start forming on the surface of the kombucha within a few days, because it wants to be up there where the top of the tea... Top of the tea hits the air. And another important thing, after you get done putting everything in the jar, cover the jar. I use a nice napkin with a rubber band around it. You want
or cheesecloth.
Or cheesecloth. You want air in there. But you don't want like...
Not a paper napkin, a cotton.
Yeah, cotton is good. Make it pretty. It's going to be out on your counter. It's good to put it out on the counter or someplace that you can check it every now and then.
So you don't forget.
Don't forget. Also, on your counter, I find a out-of-the-sunlight, in-the-corner, quiet place. I'm not going to be joggling it. Then this Scooby actually grows, puts on another layer, and it'll end up looking like a large, soggy, mushy penny with other pennies sort of adding on there. And then after 7 or 10 days, after you've tasted it,
what flavor profile you're going for in the tasting process.
The first few days it's going to taste like sweet tea. And then it starts to get a bit more effervescent and it gets a bit more sour. Now, the sour is good because it's not sour like turn up your nose. It's sour like wine, effervescent cider.
The sour is the sign of the fermentation occurring. So you're looking for the sour.
You're looking for the sour. If you leave it a long time, it will get more and more sour. And it could, if you left it for a month or something, it probably wouldn't hurt the Scooby. It probably wouldn't hurt the product. But it may be a little beyond your taste.
So you're just curing it to suit your taste.
The
amount of sourness, so it's individual. Mm-hmm. I'm going to talk about kefir also, and this is another thing where you need the kefir grains. It's called, which is this sort of little gelatinous-looking round globules.
Ooh, we're into globules.
Globules.
And note here, I've been talking about kombucha, which is a tea-based, clear drink. It's a great summertime drink. And Donna's going to talk about kefir, which is a dairy-based drink.
It's close to yogurt, but it's a different culture. The other thing I was thinking, Lana, and we haven't discussed this, but since these things require hand-me-down starters, if we have some sort of response on the KHOI web, asking if we could be matching people who have Scoobies, who want to give Scoobies, who want, that kind of thing. We could facilitate that. And the same thing will be true of the kefirs. Now, I got my kefir culture probably 4 years ago. There were two Ukrainian grad students on my block. And when the mother came to town, who's about my age, we started having, conversations because our grandchildren played together. But the conversations are gesticulations because she only spoke Russian. But she brought me a kefir culture, which I really, really treasure. And I've passed it around and passed it on, and I've even carried it back to Europe, and I've carried it to New Zealand. And
as I understand it, many of these things are drunk and enjoyed around the world, but Eastern Europe and Russia has a living kefir culture. Well, people like it.
Yeah, I think they've kept their traditions going a lot longer. In fact, I was looking up something I had mentioned to Lana. There's an old family there's an old story in our family from my son's father, who's French, that he was told many years ago, because he's a sculptor, that Brancusi, Constant Brancusi, who was a well-known
well, he was Romanian, actually, but he spent most of his life in France, that when you went into his atelier, everyone was required to stop at the pickle barrel and drink a cup of the juice. You know, he was part of his artistic ethic was to maintain and support, you know, the and honor the Romanian peasant traditions. So a lot of these Eastern European traditions do have some continuity, and we're bringing it back for us. So anyway, these kefir grains arrived, and what I like about kefir is it's actually easier to make than yogurt. You don't have to have a yogurt maker. You don't have to monitor the temperature very carefully. So there are these, and it grows like the Scooby does. So, you know, I can divide mine up, and I gave Lana some a couple of weeks ago, and all you do is take the little globs and put them in milk. I use 2%.
I use whole milk.
Well, I have to tell you, over Christmas, I put it in whole cream.
Oh, you.
OMG, as they say. It was so delicious. It really was like cream fraiche. I mean, I just couldn't stop eating it. Mm-hmm. And I kept thinking, boy, I better not do this again. I will be in so much trouble, but it's just the holidays. It was very good. So my methodology is I have a quart jar. I usually use a fairly wide mouth one because it's easier to clean. I put the kefir blob in, which is about a quarter of a cup. I just pour the milk over it. Now, I have never – there is a thing about milk you need to know. Milk, there are two levels of pasteurization because, of course, if I could get raw milk, I would do it in a heartbeat. But we can't do that in Iowa. So there is ultra – what's it? UHT – ultra high temperature, which gives the milk a longer shelf life. I tend not to use that. I think there's a little more liveliness left in the milk that hasn't been heated to those high temperatures. So let's see, who does that? Picket Fence doesn't do UHT. Who else? Oh, Kelowna naturally. What's that called? Naturally something. You can get that at the Hy-Vee. They don't use ultra-high temp either. I think Organic Valley, you have to read. Some of theirs is UHT and some of it isn't. So I recommend for making dairy cultures to use the least processed milk that you can find.
Have you ever tried goat's milk? It might work.
Oh, it would be great. I'm sure it would be great.
If anyone has a friendly goat out there, please go.
Yeah, call me. Because the problem with a lot of the goat's milk that you can buy, I haven't bought any lately, but it is also UHT, especially that the Meinenbergs that comes from California, I'm pretty sure is travels so far, they want to give maximum shelf life, which is good for some things, but it's probably not as good for kefirs. So you just fill the jar up. So that's like a quart. I just loosely cover it with a set of cup over the top, you know, to keep debris or flies or anything from going into it. And in this, I sit it out on the counter. In the winter, it usually takes about 2 days. When it's warmer in the summer, it can go in 24 hours. And then you just kind of lift the little blobs of kefir grains. They're called kefir grains, but they're not like grains.
Think cottage cheese is Mary. It's smaller, but it's sort of like that.
Yeah,
that
very loose cottage cheesy, and they're a little more translucent than a cheese. And you can either strain them off through a colander. I just kind of pick them up, put them in the next jar to start the thing, and then you pour the milk over. And there you go. You've got one working and one, as soon as you put it in the fridge, if you need to slow it down because you're going away, stick it in the fridge. It should be fine.
The same with the kombucha. Use the refrigerator or a cool space as a slower downer and a storer. Because although my recipe makes 3 quarts of kombucha at a time, I certainly don't drink 3 quarts of kombucha at a time. As a matter of fact, when I drink kombucha, I personally like to cut it about half and half with water. I'm not a big I actually do that with soda sometimes, or lemonade. I prefer the more water. So I don't drink that much at a time, so I keep it in the refrigerator. The refrigerator slows it way down, and it's a great way to keep it and have it available all the time, especially in the summertime. I really like it in the summertime. Okay. I will mention, if you want to give us your input on kombucha or what we've talked about so far, you can email us at khoiradio@gmail.com. And if you would be so kind as to put Donalana Kitchen in the subject line or kitchen in the subject line so it doesn't get mixed up with everything else that's going around here. And we shall get back to you. Let's take a little break for a little digression here. I ran across a really wonderful bit of music called Germinations, a bluegrass symphony in D. This is by a group called Grammony. Grammony is classical bluegrass. What a nice combination. And Grammony, as a small orchestra, I think there's about 7 members, they are based out of Madison, Wisconsin now. And it actually has a Ames connection because the person that wrote much of this music, the composer for this Bluegrass Symphony in D, is a past Ames resident and ISU professor named Mike Bell. He was also an alumni of the Barn Owl Band, and I've known him for a good many years, and he's always producing wonderful music. And his latest group here is Grammony. Grammony, the word Grammony, comes from the Latin Gramineae. It's a botanical term for the family of prairie grasses that include wheat, rice, corn, barley, bamboo, sugarcane, and, of course, bluegrass. We'll be listening to part of this Bluegrass Symphony in D, and it's very appropriate for what we're talking about now because Mike calls this his D composition. And this composition, it actually has 3 parts. This composition was commissioned and played first in 2012 in a little church in the rural part of southwestern Wisconsin, actually where I'm, the area where I'm from, as part of the fermentation festival that happens in Reedsburg, Wisconsin in October. And this was actually commissioned for that. It was commissioned by a wonderful group of people called the Worm Farm Institute, and I'll give that information later and how you can find out more about them. But this composition in D, actually...
The D composition.
Isn't it lovely? It was made to celebrate the land, the earth, growing things, changing things, and actually over the next years, Mike invites other composers to take part of this composition and decompose it and rewrite it again. And so these things are always being rewritten, resung, but this is how it existed in 2012. Thank you. Okay. You were listening to Germinations, a bluegrass symphony in D, also known as a decomposition by Mike Bell and the Grammony Bluegrass Orchestra. We're talking about fermentation today. I'd like to remind you that you are listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. My name is Lana.
And I'm Donna.
And we're here on KHOI Radio, 89.1 FM in the center of Story County, serving all sorts of small communities and big-hearted people in the center of the state here. I want to mention that we've been having a little technical difficulties, so it's not you.
In the transmission, apparently. If we're cutting out.
Yeah.
There's going to be a replay at 7 o'clock tonight where you can hopefully hear the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
So if you missed something that was critical in the explanation of the Scooby, do tune in for the details again.
7 o'clock this evening for the Donna Lana Kitchen. We're sort of a new incarnation here on the community radio station. Community radio is a little different than a lot of other radio stations. Donna and I are both volunteers along with everybody else here. So we kind of make this up as we go along, and we're better together because we all bring our skills to KHOI Radio. Good. Well, let's get back to the show. I want to thank a past emailer for emailing in our first email ever, and it's lovely. We had a question last week about feeding a cold or starving a fever, or starving a cold and feeding a fever, and one of our erstwhile listeners just got right on the horn and said, "Hello, radio hosts. I just caught a few minutes of the show driving home for lunch. My curiosity was piqued, and I did this brief web search. Regardless of the result, I'm planning on feeding both colds and fevers with delicious homemade chicken soup, which I am warming up right now."
Bravo.
Yes. Anyway, the information he sent says, current medical opinion puts feed a cold, starve a fever maxim in the same category as other medical advice from the Middle Ages. False, and maybe even dangerous. An infection, particularly one associated with fevers, is no time to deny your body the nutrients and fluids it needs. So for both of those things, drink a lot of liquids.
And this is from Thomas Russell, a registered piano technician.
Yes.
And drinker, thank you, Thomas.
And drinker of chicken soup. Thanks for that information. We'll get back to our topic. We are fermenting and fomenting all sorts of ideas here. We've been talking about kefir. We've been talking about kombucha.
And this is all because Sander Katz, the author of The Art of Fermentation, a James Beard Award-winning book, will be in Ames. So I'm going to announce where he's going to be. Wednesday, January 22nd, he will be in at 8 o'clock in the Great Hall in the Memorial Union. He'll actually also be at Colloquium, which is a sustainable ag program open to the public, Wednesday at 3 o'clock. These are both on Wednesday, and that is in Agronomy 2050 on campus. Then the next day, he will actually be teaching a hands-on workshop, and those first two events on Wednesday are free and open to the public. The Linden Hall on January 23rd at 3 o'clock on Thursday is also open to the public, but you must register. You need a little reservation, and you go to isucats@gmail.com, right? gmails.com. So that's isucats@gmail.com for the Thursday hands-on sauerkraut demonstration. And then this is sponsored on campus by the Ag Arts Group and ISU Dining. Then a further sponsor of CATS here in Ames is Practical Farmers of Iowa, where he will be appearing at 12:30 on Friday at the Sheman Center. The PFI conference does require registration, which is $35 for members. This is a one day. The whole conference is 2 days, but if you're only coming for the CATS thing, it's $35 for members, $25 for students, $50 for non-members. But that also gets you into the keynote by Ricardo Salvador, who's an agronomist formerly of ISU, now with the Union of Concerned Scientists. And his speech
which should be interesting to all of us, is True Wealth, How Iowa Can Once Again Revolutionize Agriculture. So if you happen to want to go to the PFI, you will get a double whammy for Mercado, Salvador, and Sandor Katz. So those are the appearances for Sandor. And that's why we're all excited talking fermentation here.
Yes. Sauerkraut. We're back to sauerkraut. That's probably one thing that people can think about that they either like or don't, but pretty much everyone knows what sauerkraut is. It's sauerkraut is fermented cabbage. And it helped a lot of our ancestors, a whole lot of generations, get through a winter. We didn't always have refrigeration right. or canned food or, heaven forbid, grocery stores.
We haven't even talked about that fermentation is actually a preservation technique. That's important historically.
Now, think how important it is that human beings figured out how to keep food from bountiful times through long cold winters or through long parts of drought when food wasn't available. Sauerkraut was one way to do it. How people discovered this, I have no idea. But fermentation happens pretty much anyway, and someone was probably brave enough to try it.
Right. So you want the good fermentation as opposed to the bad fermentation. So you're controlling a natural process by whatever cultures and bacteria and fungi that you are actually introducing to the food. So tell us about your sauerkraut experiences.
Okay. I am a newbie to sauerkraut, but I have read things and watched other people make it. My husband Joe and I were blessed with lots of extra cabbage. I happen to have a 2-gallon ceramic crock, which was previously holding a potted plant, but I put it to better use. Started out with cabbage, a Cuisinart, salt, and a stomper. I have a, from family, I have a wooden sauerkraut stomper, which is a really nice way to stomp things down. The important part of sauerkraut is to not only chop it up fine, but also help the salt and water and the microbes get into the molecular structure of the sauerkraut. And you do that by breaking things up. Chop up the sauerkraut, or chop up the cabbage.
And like thin slices.
Thin slices. You could do it with a knife, but the Cuisinart is ever so much nicer.
I use an electric meat slicer. It's really a whiz.
They'd be lovely. And put the chopped up cabbage in layers in the crock. And again, as we were talking about with kefir and with kombucha, we're dealing with living things here. So a non-reactive sort of crock, glass or ceramic.
This is really why, if you go to an antique store or an auction, you will see a lot of crocks for sale because everyone had them, 5-gallon, 2-gallon, 1-gallon, 3-gallon. And these were largely used, I think, for sauerkraut and pickles,
Yes. Especially
in this part of the country anyway. Mm-hmm. So crocks are not only ornamental, charming antiques. They're very useful.
Because they're just the right size. They have a nice wide open top, again, for access and to let the air in. As you put the cabbage into the crock, you use some sort of stomper downer, a big wooden thing, or your fist.
It's like this. She brought her pestle in, and it's actually lovely. It's a flat-bottomed
wooden pounder thing.
Kind of in a bell shape, really, yeah. With a good handle. Mm-hmm. And I remember once Mary Swander was talking about how she makes sauerkraut, and she was saying she learned from the Amish over around Kelowna where she lives, and they actually work the salt in with their hands, and that the main thing is to get the salt into the cabbage, not on it, into it.
Yes.
So the pounding or the massaging I think is rather critical.
And smushing it down. So you end up, my crock, 2-gallon crock, ended about 2/3 full of chopped up cabbage, and every time I put another handful in, I sprinkled some salt. you can look up on different recipes. It's
and does it start to juice out right away when the salt
does.
Hits the
cabbage? It does, because cabbage will draw moisture out of will draw moisture out of the cabbage, plus all the pounding. So when you get it full and pounded down as tight as you can or firmly as you can, you cover up that whole bunch with...
Wait, so you throw in cabbage and salt at the same time?
Yeah, alternate.
And what kind of salt did you use?
I use sea salt. You probably don't want You probably don't want to use iodized salt.
Yeah.
Because...
The normal, like Morton's, they also have anti-caking agents in them and things like that that you may not be so successful if you introduce your culture to that.
Yeah, because again, we're trying to encourage the microbes and bacteria, which are in the air. Don't want to shock anybody, but it's in the air. Now you want that to
called wild fermentation. It's
wild
everywhere.
It is everywhere. And then let's see. I'll put a plate that just happened to fit on top of my crock, on top of the cabbage. I put a jug full of water on top of that to weight it down. You can use anything that's heavy, but that's a nice clean thing to put on top. And then I covered the whole thing with a cloth. Again, air goes in and out. But again, I don't want like mice or heaven knows, or flies.
I mean, the idea is to keep all the sauerkraut submerged. This is what the weight and the lid or plate are for, is to keep no air gets to the cabbage. It's submerged in its own water, brine kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Once you actually do it, it's not that tricky. The description is a little odd, but that's how it works.
And I put it originally in our basement, which actually was too cool. Nothing much seemed to be happening, so I moved it up to the kitchen underneath the counter. And I'm tasting it as I go. It's getting more and more sauerkraut-like and less and less cabbage-like.
How long ago did you start this?
That was a month ago.
All right, so you're a month into it,
and it's starting
to... Tune back in, folks, for the report again on this growing experimental life force in Lana's kitchen.
Oh, yeah. One thing is growing. That's good. Let's see, what else do we want to talk
about here? Oh, we wanted to talk about pickled garlic and black garlic.
Yes. I received... as a Christmas present, a little bag that had two rather darkish looking, but not black, two garlic heads in it. And it says, it's from Black Garlic of North America. This is evidently a new old sort of thing. In the search that I've done for this, it seems like black garlic is kind of the latest taste for a lot of folks in fancy-schmancy restaurants.
Insert here that this is particularly interesting to Lana because she and Joe grow some of the best garlic in Storr County.
Oh, my. Well, I have no idea how to make it. I am just being introduced to this. But Don and I sat down with
in a kitchen.
We had a tasting. Opened up this head of garlic, and we had black cloves that look sort of like, they look caramelized in place is what it looked like. And according to what I've read about it, it's artisanal, sweet, aged, fermented garlic. I don't know how they ferment or how they age. I do know, according to the literature, that it is heated for a very long time in a real gentle sort of way. I can explain the taste. The taste is sort of like balsamic vinegar. It's sort of like. Oh, I don't know what. Would you say that?
Well, it tasted to me sort of like if I had slow, either steamed or slow roasted the garlic with balsamic vinegar. It was sweet sour. We took the clove out of the peel, and we smashed it on a piece of toast to kind of spread it around, and then munched it down. It's a very delightful, deep flavor.
It is
so
lovely.
We're going to try and recreate it ourselves
around the harvest time when Lana gets her next batch of garlic.
And if anybody else has any experience with something called black garlic from this company is called Black Garlic of North America, and their website is blackgarlicna.com, Black Garlic of North America. And find out more about it. It's pretty, pretty fascinating. Always nice to try new things.
Oh, it's a business division of Wisconsin Fermentation Company, which is focused on fermentation innovation. So, of course, Lana and I want to know how we can make this ourselves.
Yeah. Let's kind of wrap up here because we've got some things to remind you of. We'll give you some websites and start the music up again because we'll hear a little bit more from Gramini and their decomposition project. And we'll just keep on talking here. One thing I want to remind you of is this is KHOI Radio. We're the Donna Lana Kitchen. And if you want to contact us, please email us at khoiradio@gmail.com and put the word kitchen in the subject line so it doesn't get mixed up with it. There's all kinds of things going on here, so heaven knows where your email would go. Let us know that you're talking to the kitchen folks. So we're the Donna Lana Kitchen. Another thing I want to remind you of is the upcoming Practical Farmers annual conference, which will feature Sandor Katz. Their website is practicalfarmers.org. I mentioned earlier that there's something called the Worm Farm Institute that's up in Wisconsin, and they are responsible for a lot of fermenting. That actually, they have a festival in October, and they're part of the music today, or they commissioned the music today, and they're the wormfarminstitute.org. You can find out more about black garlic, blackgarlicna.com.
We also, in addition to Sanders' books, one is called The Art of Fermentation. That's the James Beard one. His earlier book was called Wild Fermentation. Another book that I do want to recommend that's more of a recipe book, it's called Mastering Fermentation, Recipes for Making and Cooking with Fermented Foods by Mary Carlin, K-A-R-L-I-N. And Lana had another book, a Bill Molson book.
Well, this is an old book, but it's lovely to look through. It's called The Permaculture Book of Ferment and Human Nutrition. And on a future show, I think I'll read some fun stuff I've learned in there. He traveled all over the world and gathered all sorts of wonderful sorts of things that people ferment.
I believe he's Australian. So
we want to thank you for tuning in to Donna Lana Kitchen. And listen to us again, repeated at 7 o'clock this evening. Thank you.
And go see Sandor Katz while he's in town.